This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Harriet Tubman's name is familiar to just about every American schoolchild. She's an American hero, an escaped slave who risked her life over and over again to lead other slaves to freedom on the Underground Railroad. Her story's been told and retold, but almost always in books for children. The last serious biography was published in 1943. That long and curious gap in scholarly interest appears to be over. This year, three new biographies have come out. Catherine Clinton, the author of Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, is our guest today. Later, we'll talk about a new traveler's guide to the history of the civil rights movement and about a new exhibit on quilts which provided illustrated maps to freedom in code. But first, Harriet Tubman. If you have questions about this famous but also little-known woman, join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Catherine Clinton joins us from the studios of Samana Productions in Stamford, Connecticut. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
And how do we explain that apparent contradiction of a world-famous woman whose life is little known?
Well, she was such a mythical character because she was born enslaved, she seized her own freedom, she seized the freedom of others, and became known as the Moses of her people. So she was quite well known in the decade before the Civil War. And then during fighting during the Civil War, she earned her reputation as a warrior. Yet, we find that because she was so much larger than life, she's become almost folkloric, and we know very little about the real woman behind the myth of Moses.
And she was illiterate and left no descriptions of her own life in her own hand.
That's true, but she did dictate letters because she was in touch with the clandestine network of freedom fighters who fought before the Civil War and during the Civil War. And she also, after the war, when she retired to upstate New York, and although she didn't retire, she left the battlefield to fight during peacetime for justice, she solicited letters, she solicited support for her charity and her outreach and her community. And many Civil War generals and abolitionists gave testimony to her life, which was published in Sketches in the Life of Harriet Tubman in 1869. So we do have records, testimony of people talking about her heroism and her remarkable contributions.
Mm-hmm. Now, your biography, is, as I mentioned, is one of three out this year. I understand there are as many as three more on the way. Why all of the sudden interest?
Well, let 100 Harriets bloom, because it's been really over a half century since we've really examined her with a scholarly eye for detail. And I think she needs to be contextualized, which both makes her achievement so much more remarkable, and also tells us about what was going on. The Underground Railroad was a vibrant, exciting part of the antebellum era, and we don't have much scholarly literature on this, but with the opening of the Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati later this year, and with new books on the Underground Railroad coming out, perhaps we can really get to these incredible stories, these remarkable lives of people who contributed, none more significantly than Harriet Tubman. She was able to go back and not just rescue her five brothers, but also her elderly parents, taking them out in a rattletrap cart by traveling by night, resting by day. She was able to take out scores of people who were willing to follow her in peril, who were willing to follow her despite the bloodhounds, and indeed she made a new life for freedom, taking scores all the way up to Canada. She settled in St. Catharines in Ontario and created an Afro-Canadian community of freedom fighters there. That's where John Brown met her, up in Ontario.
Back to John Brown in a minute, but because of the railroad analogy, we think of her as the conductor of the railroad. In fact, as I understand it, the terminology at the time was that she was an abductor.
Yes, because a conductor was someone who took the cargo of escaped slaves from safe house to safe house, or depot to station, within the lingo of the UGRR. But she was someone who went behind enemy lines into the South. There were certainly slave hunters seeking her. She was a well-known bandit along the eastern shore because she was returning to her home counties to free people she knew, to free people who knew people she knew, and she was so intrepid that we really have to try and imagine what the dangers she faced with each trip deep into the South. And this deep into the South, we only have a handful of abductors that we can chronicle, and all of them we know about because they were caught. But as she said later in life, I never lost a passenger with great pride.
Mm-hmm. Now, for those whose grasp of geography of the state of Maryland may be somewhat lacking, the Eastern Shore is that part of on the Delmarva Peninsula that is on the other side of the Chesapeake Bay, and that's where she was born and where she grew up. And one of the fascinating things about your book is that it indicates this was an area of the old antebellum South where slaves were raised almost as a cash crop.
Well, they were one of the greatest cash crops during the antebellum period with the closing of the international slave trade. Slaves were traded south and all over Maryland. Georgia traders, as they were known, were people coming north seeking property. We also know in this Delmarva region that you had bands of slave catchers. Indeed, there were slave kidnappers. There were people who were kidnapping free blacks in the city of Philadelphia, so much so the mayor had to put out a reward, a bounty for those people who came in, stole free blacks, sneaked them down the peninsula, and sold them into slavery in Virginia. You have hundreds of court cases at the time. So vigilance committees formed in cities like Baltimore, like Philadelphia, New York, to protect free blacks. And out of these vigilance committees protecting free blacks from being kidnapped came the remnants of the organization of the Underground Railroad.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking with Catherine Clinton, who's the author of the newly published Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom. And let's talk with David, who's on the line with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Hi. I wondered if in any of your research you did run across anything about the archaeological record as it applies to the Underground Railroad and the paucity of physical archaeological remnants that speak to places and their meaning in the Underground Railroad itself.
Well, as I mentioned, later this year, the Underground Railroad Railroad Freedom Center will be opening in Cincinnati, and it's an outreach program as far north as Vermont, as far west as Colorado. You have people doing digs, doing sites, trying to collect pieces of information. Recently, we've had articles about Underground Railroad safe houses in Brooklyn. We know that there were so many in Ohio, in the Midwest, in Kentucky, in Maryland, and they're turning up all the time. Archaeologically, the only research I really did was to go to the Harriet Tubman birthplace, where the state of Maryland is conducting a dig in Bucktown, Maryland. So that was the archaeology that I explored during my research.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call, David. It can't have been easy to do the research. I'm just, you're describing the relationship with her husband, and you're saying what evidence remains from family lore indicates that Araminta, her born name,
her birth name,
was deeply in love with John Tubman because she considered herself married to him for life. They most likely exchanged religious vows that include the pledge until death do us part. There are no records for a lot of this stuff.
No, indeed, slave marriages were not recorded, nor do you find family Bibles with genealogies inscribed. So in some ways, Harriet Tubman is a dream character, larger than life, amazing feats, amazing story. People would testify about her. We have lots of letters and people saying, I met the famous Harriet Tubman, one of the big guns of the Underground Railroad. At the same time, it's a nightmare to try and piece together the evidence, but it is wonderful and exciting. We know, for example, that she seized her own freedom in 1849. She took to the road. She left her home counties. She wanted her husband, a free black, to go with her, but John Tubman refused. She went on alone. And we know this. At the same time, we had no documentary evidence, but in 2003, an intrepid local historian who runs the Bucktown Village Foundation, Bucktown Store Foundation in Bucktown, Maryland, discovered a dumpster where a family who'd lived in the area since before the Civil War was closing out a house and emptying the attic. And he asked if he might go in and look. He searched through the papers and found, lo and behold, a runaway advertisement in one of the papers. So in 2003, we have documentary evidence of Harriet Tubman's running away turning up.
Let's get another caller on the line. Janet is with us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm ashamed to say I never heard of Harriet Tubman until my daughter did a report for her class. And my daughter was also very privileged to have met Archbishop Desmond Tutu, came to her school. And when we did this research on Harriet Tubman for her report, I was just amazed at the time that this woman lived in and what she had to do. Just took a heck of a lot of guts, that's all I can say. And
Let the children let us know. Certainly there are almost 40 children's books in print. But the fact that it took half a century before a new adult biography came out, to me, is really a scandal. She's a hero. She was someone that we can all learn from, and it's up from the children's shelf and into the pantheon of American warriors. That's where she belongs. She was a patriot, too. She really was proud of having fought with the Union Army. She was proud of having brought her people to freedom, and she's a great role model for children and for adults.
It'd make a good movie.
Absolutely.
Thanks for the call, Janet.
You're welcome.
You mentioned the gap in serious scholarship, and would one of the explanations for that gap be historians' reluctance to go into areas without the kind of documentation that they're used to looking at?
Well, I think perhaps we train our students at prestigious graduate schools to go into the archives, and again, I say up from the archives. When I was teaching at Harvard in the African American Studies Department in the early 1990s, and I was assigned an encyclopedia article on Harriet Tubman, imagine my surprise at not being able to find new material or in the reference works. And now I'm glad to say that with this renaissance in Underground Railroad work, with this renaissance in slave studies, we're now able to say we're going to recover those hidden lives. We're going to go in and we're going to find material. We're going to dig. We're going to be intense. And indeed, the WPA narratives, which have been released, and we now have audio recordings, we now have printed records, we can really get at new, we can interrogate old sources, and we can also use oral history. And I try in my work not to privilege the written record over oral history, because as a scholar in African American studies, this is a very important component. The stories handed down are stories that we need to listen to.
Yes, we need to listen to them, but as a trained historian, do they have the same weight?
Well, we have to weigh them. It's a mosaic. Certainly when I have...
Not to say printed records are always accurate either.
No. I mean, one of the things might be that one can look to what is... When we're trying to find obituaries and look at the records, we find discrepancies. When we're trying to find Harriet Tubman's age, we find random discrepancies. Congressmen saying she's in her 80s in the 1890s, when she knows she might have been 70, but certainly not in her 80s. We look to these records and we weigh them all. I certainly believe in being scrupulous and trying to look at the written record, but I also say when you're working with clandestine lives, when you're looking at people that were living as fugitives in the North, naturally their records are not as well kept. We know in 1850, when the United States published a fugitive slave law, that those people who were keeping scrupulous records tore them up. Why? Because not only did they not want to have incriminating evidence in their own hand, but because escaped slaves would take new names in freedom. And in taking those new names, they would write them down and keep a record. They had to destroy these records lest they be discovered. And the new names of all these fugitives living in the Underground Railroad above ground would be discovered.
We're speaking with Catherine Clinton. Her newly published book is called Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom. If you'd like to join us, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the life of Harriet Tubman with biographer Catherine Clinton. If you have a question about her life, you're invited to join us. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to Jeffrey. And Jeffrey's on the line with us from Syracuse, New York.
Yes, near Auburn, New York, where the Harriet Tubman home is, and also a hotbed of abolitionist movements in that era. And
the Jerry Rescue.
Pardon?
The Jerry Rescue, the public rescue of a fugitive slave.
Yes, by a Unitarian minister, and that actually happened in Syracuse. And the home of William Seward, who I understand I had befriended Harriet Tubman, and I thought there was some relationship there that you might develop a little bit for us. But also, I'm curious, I've been out to her home a couple of times, and it seems that it's quite underfunded. They're barely able to staff it and barely able to make repairs, and I was quite astonished that you know, someone of this reputation, that her home would be you know, such a difficult proposition to have in, you know, historical repair for you know, for generations to see. There wouldn't be some, you know, generous funders.
Jeffrey, I assume this is the same William Seward who, as Secretary of State, negotiated the purchase of Alaska.
Yes, and also who invented the insanity defense and murder trials.
Okay, well, one out of two isn't bad. Anyway.
Uh-huh. Let's talk about his relationship to Harriet, though, who's a great admirer of hers, and he indeed sold her a home in Auburn, which was his hometown, and she was able to buy her own house on favorable terms, where she did spend the rest of her life. They were great friends. He was her patron. At one point, she was soliciting him after the Civil War, asking for a charitable donation for one of her causes, and he said, "I won't give you money, Harriet, unless you promise to spend it on yourself," because she was known to be so incredibly generous. He was someone who very much supported her. He was someone who, throughout his long life, was a family friend to her. And indeed, he there are rumors that in his home, fugitive slaves were sheltered. And we know that Auburn, again, was a great hotbed. You mentioned the Harriet Tubman home, which is an educational center and outreach. And indeed, I write about this in the epilogue of my book, in the legacy section, that I'm concerned because Harriet Tubman was such a great American that I believe it's time we honor her. There are statues going up from Battle Creek to the south end of Boston, but her birthplace in Cambridge, Maryland, and her final resting place of Auburn, New York, both have, as you point out, understaffed, underfunded projects that need, I think, care and attention, that need more support. But however, I want to salute the generations of really tireless volunteers, the men and especially women of these communities, and the AME Zion Church, which has supported the Harriet Tubman home, the Harriet Tubman organization. It's really the tireless efforts of these people. The National Park Service now has a major study looking at how a Harriet Tubman Park could be developed to honor this great American. And so I think it is being looked into, and I'm glad you brought this to our attention.
And Jeffrey, I think anybody who's ever been through a winter in Auburn, New York, would understand why William Seward thought it was perfectly reasonable to buy Alaska.
Indeed. In fact, his home, Doris Kearns Goodwin, was here doing some studies on Seward. I think she's maybe doing a biography. But the Seward home is actually a real treasure. She considers it one of the great historical houses in the United States for the people who might want to visit it.
Well, thank you.
It's just down the road from the Harriet Tubman home. And I know that Doris Goodwin would support efforts to get the Harriet Tubman home to measure up. And I know that Senator Clinton of New York has been working on this behalf. And I think it's a wonderful effort for us in the 21st century to put at the top of our agenda.
Thanks very much for the call, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Audrey, and Audrey's with us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Greetings.
Hi.
I'm interested in hearing the story about what I've heard about Harriet Tubman leading the Cumbie River Revolt in South Carolina.
Yes, she
and
was...
I just don't know the story. I've seen it as a footnote in another book, but I haven't actually heard the story.
Well, of course, I hope you'll go out and buy Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, where it's prominently featured. But it is true that I found it as a footnote. Being a Civil War historian, someone who studies gender in the Civil War, I wanted to know, what was this raid? And it's really a remarkable situation where Harriet was working in South Carolina for the Union Army as a nurse, as a helpmeet of the contrabands coming in. But the generals recognized that with her expertise, they were really having a secret weapon there in camp, and they sent her out into the countryside. She was able to round up a group of scouts. She even was able to find some of the African Americans who had laid the mines on the Cumbie River. And getting that intelligence, she could go back to the Union command. She could tell them that if they led a raid, taking gunboats up the river, she knew she could liberate slaves off of these plantations, the grandees of South Carolina, the Middletons and other families. She would be able to lead them to take the slaves away, and indeed they burned many of the plantations. In one night, June 2, 1863, the gunboats went up the river. They made the call for freedom. 750 slaves joined the Union gunboats and came back to freedom in that one night. It was a great, sweet victory, and I think very, very fitting that when they came back on June the 3rd, that was the very same day that the Massachusetts 54th, sailing down from Massachusetts, landed in South Carolina. So what a day of jubilee that was.
Audrey, thanks for the question.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. All right, here's an email question. Your guest just mentioned that Harriet Tubman is a dream character. I know she was using the term in a different way, but I read just yesterday in a book on dreams that she was well known to have used her own dreams to find routes to take the people she led to slavery, to safety, rather. Is there any truth to this, or is this part of the folklore that's accumulated over the years?
Well, we do know that she was thought by many of her friends to be a prophet. We do know that she spoke about her dreams. She actually had a dream of a man coming up, his face appearing to her, being surrounded by a mob. And later, when she met John Brown, that was the man that she said appeared to her in her dreams. We know that she suffered from a lifelong disability. Some have prescribed it might have been narcolepsy. Others are suggesting it might be temporal lobe epilepsy. Whatever it was, it led her to have very vivid, dramatic hallucinations. People who do suffer from narcolepsy have what are called hypnagogic hallucinations, very vivid dreams. And so there were times when she said she was going down a road, she felt as if she heard the voice of God, she turned away, went a different direction, and it was later discovered that there were patrollers on the road. So it is a matter of folklore, but it's also a matter of truth that she saw visions, she saw things, and she let her faith guide her. She was a deeply spiritual person, and all who met her were struck by it.
It is extraordinary to realize, I mean, not exceptional enough to have, won her own freedom, but then to go back time and again. What was it that motivated? Do we know what motivated her?
Well, we try and look into her past. At first, when I discovered, of course, that Frederick Douglass was born about 30 miles away from her birthplace, I thought, what is it in the water along the eastern shore of Maryland that led to these great freedom fighters, these dreamers? But it is true that from an early age, we try and piece things together. So a minister who knew her later in life said once one of her masters, and she had a whole string of masters because she was hired out by her owner, from the age of 5, she was put into service, asked to work all day and then rock a cradle of a baby at night, a baby that she could barely hold. And when she was one of these masters attempted to punish her, seizing a hold of her, she bit him on the knee. And he never tried to punish her again. And that's one of the few glimpses we have of childhood. And that's what I meant about her being a bit of a nightmare, because we have so little to go on. Mm-hmm. We piece it together. But I am trying to give a story to my readers, a complete story of how she fits into this fight for freedom that Americans so cherish.
Let's go now to Debbie, who's with us from Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Hello.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I think she's an interesting person, and if it wasn't for children's books and Christian radio stations having things about her, I don't think I would know as much about her as I do.
I think you're right. She has been kept alive in the hearts and minds of school children, but also certainly people who look upon her as a leader, as someone whose spirituality tells us something today, that here she was deprived of an education, deprived of personhood, seizing her own freedom. And later in life, when she might have rested on her laurels, she might have slowed down, she instead built her own charity home. She bought some property at auction, she raised the funds, she went to others, solicited donations, because she wanted a home for the aged, the indigent, and especially disabled veterans. It was the only facility outside New York City available to African Americans. She never slowed down. Her motto was keep going.
Debbie, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Email from Maggie in Orchard Park, New York. That's up near Buffalo. Listeners should bear in mind that even after the Civil War, Harriet Tubman was not afforded the same rights as other Americans. She worked for the women's rights movement as well to bring freedom to those discriminated against because of gender. Is that right?
Absolutely. Someone asked her after the war if she believed in rights for women, and she said, "I've suffered enough to know so." She was someone who would take her shawl, take her bag, go down to the railroad station, wait for the next train, and go off to a women's suffrage meeting. She was so honored by Susan B. Anthony and others who recognized that her being such an outspoken champion of rights for women was important. The National Association of Colored Women, who held their first meeting, invited her. She was the eldest delegate. She was someone who spoke out in favor of rights for women, and she lived that example.
After doing all of the research and you know, obviously going through whatever records are available, do you think that you got a glimpse into to the woman who was Harriet Tubman, as well as into the records of the legend, the hero?
Yes, I believe that I felt as if I was moving through the documents, meeting people to talk about her, finding in every nook and cranny, from cyberspace where children would post things up to a recent email I got from some men doing a reading group for Black History Month in the MTA maintenance shop in New York City, the actual Underground Railroad men, that she is someone who people want to know. And I did as much as I could to bring this incredible character to life in my book, that we no longer have to treat her as a myth. We have to look at her as a flesh and blood hero and someone who is a deep patriot and can make us all proud, black and white, men and women, that we're Americans.
Describe her for us. I know she was only 5 feet high.
That's right. She was 5 feet, and she was, at one point in life on the Underground Railroad, she had an abscessed tooth and pain and worried about infection. She was forced to take her pistol, knock out her upper teeth. We know that people talked about her having a scowl, but that was a result of a childhood injury when she stood up between an overseer throwing an iron weight at another slave and took a blow to the head. So physically, she was impressive, and also from photographs we know that whenever she spoke in public, she was always wearing a lace collar, a lace cuff. She tried to behave in a very, she tried to appear ladylike and dignified, which she was, because she wanted to defy those who would stereotype her. She had the reputation, of course, of being manly. She was nicknamed the General by John Brown, but she also wanted to say that a woman too could take her place and fight and appear to be dignified and appear to be someone of worth and value in a society which so devalued most African American women and put them on the auction block.
Catherine Clinton, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Catherine Clinton is the author of Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, and she was with us from the studios of Samana Productions in Stamford, Connecticut. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.